Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, April 16th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll start with the five-day forecast for the Siouxland area. And today it looks like it's going to be rain most of the day, stronger in the morning than in the afternoon. The high today of 72 and a low tonight of 45. Wednesday looks like it's going to be breezy and cooler with a high of 66 and a low of 43. Thursday will be mainly cloudy and it will be cooler again with a high of 56 and a low of 30. And then Friday, there'll be clouds with some sunshine with a high of 54 and a low of 31. And Saturday is going to be cooler again and have both clouds and sun with a high of 48 and a low of 28. Our top story today is about the Siouxland Chamber of Commerce trip to Washington, D.C. When the Siouxland Chamber of Commerce arrives in Washington, D.C. this week for its 69th annual lobbying trip, the mission is clear: to get congressional support for millions of dollars worth of upgrades to infrastructure at the 185th Air Refueling Wing and the Sioux City Wastewater Treatment Plant. In the matter of the 185th, replacing the runway, ramp, and aging hangar from 1957, the chamber delegation would like to get one thing straight. This should not be thought of as an earmark. Chris McGowan, president of the Siouxland Chamber, said, "Several members of our congressional delegation are philosophically opposed to earmarks. This is a request to fulfill a funding commitment that was made two decades ago during the conversion from one aircraft to another. The chamber delegation, somewhat less than 50 people, is set to meet with all six senators representing Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota, and all eight representatives of the states, along with West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin's chief of staff, and representatives of think tanks and policy organizations, including the American Immigration Council and the Heritage Foundation. The project is said to be essential to the continued operation of the 185th. In 2003, the 185th transitioned from the relatively small, lightweight F-16 Fighting Falcon to the extremely heavy KC-135 straddle tanker. The latter functions essentially as a flying gas station, used to refuel military aircraft in mid-air. It was during this time that the 185th was redesignated as the Air Refueling Wing. Before that, it was the 185th Fighter Wing. As part of that transition, the Pentagon pledged the 185th would get the infrastructure upgrades necessary to support the weight and the size of the KC-135. That promise was mothballed amid the upheaval of the War on Terror as the military prioritized other projects. Colonel Sonia Morrison, wing commander of the 185th, wrote in an analysis of the situation, "At that time, engineers identified problems with runway length, pavement subbase, and parking apron strength, since they were designed to support the fighter mission. Over the past 20 years, we accomplished repairs, but the long-term effects of operating stopped giving the 185th a waiver to operate its KC-135s by 2027, when the added lifespan of the 2022 repairs is expected to run out." Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, and Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen in October signed a letter demanding the Department of Defense fund the 185th infrastructure project. The letter said, "As fiscal responsibility remains a top priority for each of our respective administrations, as well as a hallmark of your service in Congress, it is critically important to note that this request is neither an earmark nor an insert, but the fulfillment of a commitment that was long discounted in the way of the tragic events of 9/11 and the subsequent military mobilization for the decades-long War on Terror." In a statement, Iowa Senator Joni Ernst signaled her support for the 185th and the $185 million project. Ernst said in a statement, I look forward to hosting the Siouxland Chamber of Commerce during their annual visit to Washington, D.C. As a combat veteran, I understand the importance of the 185th Air Refueling Wing and will continue to push the Air Force to uphold its commitment to Siouxlanders. I am grateful for the opportunity to serve the hardworking men and women of the Siouxland Chamber and provide support at the federal level. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, in a statement, did not explicitly say whether he would support the expenditures the chamber plans to advocate. His statement said, "Hearing directly from Iowans informs my work and helps me better understand my constituents' needs. I look forward to meeting with the chamber next week and discussing what matters most to Siouxland, including military construction and infrastructure." And then the rebuilding of Sioux City's aging wastewater treatment plant at 3100 South Lewis Boulevard is expected to be one of the city's priciest municipal undertakings in recent memory. The plant poses significant safety issues for city staff and has a history of state environmental compliance violations. The project is expected to cost $470 million. McGowan warned the Sioux City Council last year that the city risks jeopardizing its relationship with the business community if they did not tap the brakes on the project. The council voted to increase residential, commercial, and industrial sewer rates to help defray the costs associated with the plant, and the project is moving forward. In Washington, the chamber delegation is planning to seek money to help cover the cost of the project, though it has not set a specific dollar figure. And it wants to go through the Federal Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, signed into law by President Joe Biden in 2021. The law provides billions of dollars for water infrastructure upgrades. McGowan said in a position paper, "Unfortunately, it is well beyond the scope of reason for anyone to logically conclude that a city of 85,000 people and a metro area with a population of 143,000 could realistically absorb a $500 million expense, which grows to a monumental expenditure of $700 million when principal and interest are factored into the total cost." McGowan did acknowledge in his position paper that industrial users did contribute significantly to the degradation of the plant. For decades, this facility has processed wastewater for one of the largest food processing metros in the United States, McGowan wrote. The heavy wastewater demands generated by large companies invested in preparing, protecting, and providing our national food supply have taken an enormous toll on the infrastructure of this facility, which, until recently, has served both residents and businesses in Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota. But McGowan also told the Journal that residential users will likely end up footing quite a bit of the bill for the plant, not the industrial users. McGowan said, "The cost is so enormous that some private sector businesses are in the process of evaluating whether they should invest significant financial resources in on-site pre-treatment infrastructures to reduce their reliance on the municipal wastewater treatment plant. If they ultimately do so, it significantly reduces the burden on industrial and other large-scale private sector businesses. Residential users will be left to fund more of the cost of this $470 million project." And our next two stories are about the Sioux City Council meeting yesterday. The first one, headline, is "Citizens Convey Support for Cultural Inclusion Liaison." During Monday's Sioux City Council meeting, a handful of citizens spoke in support of the city's cultural inclusion liaison, who has been serving an indefinite suspension since February. Some of them held artwork featuring Semhar Gebrekidze's likeness, which was created by local artist Jessica Hammond. Hammond was among Gebrekidze's supporters who addressed the council. Hammond said, "This artwork I created is a representation of Semhar and all the beautiful work she does in our community. She is educated, highly qualified, and recognized as a leader, not only locally, but nationally. She listens to people. She connects people with the resources they need and gives everybody a chance for their voices to be heard." According to an internal memo obtained by the Journal, Gebrekidze was suspended with pay effective February 21st, pending the completion of an investigation concerning violations of city work rules. Gebrekaden, who has been employed with the city since 2021 and oversees the Inclusive Sioux City Advisory Committee, reports to the city manager's office and is not a department head. City staff and council members have said little publicly about her suspension. City Attorney Nicole Dubois said personnel matters are confidential and the city is prohibited from comments. Dubois also denied multiple open records requests concerning her Gebrekaden's suspension, which were made by the Journal under the Freedom of Information Act. Mayor Bob Scott previously said Gebrekaden has hired an attorney, so the city council does not have the privilege or the opportunity to say anything in the public about that. On Monday, Scott read a prepared statement that said the city and the council is committed to creating more opportunities for inclusivity and supports the efforts of the Inclusive Sioux City Advisory Committee, which provides guidance to the council on matters relating to diversity, inclusion, and equity. Scott said the personnel matter involving Gebrekaden will not be discussed publicly. He said, with that does not mean citizens cannot speak to the council that is unable to respond. Greg Golker, a history professor at Morningside University and founder of the Yamanashi City Sister City Committee, told the council he's gotten to know Gebrekaden through on-campus activities. He said Gebrekaden has met with multiple and diverse campus groups and shared a message that is meant to encourage young people to get more involved in the community. He said, I want to emphasize simply that Semhar has always been a pleasure to work with. I found Semhar to be professional, organized, thoughtful, welcoming, and very enthusiastic about the Sister City project. I hope to be able to work with Semhar again. Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore thanked those who spoke for their remarks. On March 28th, LaShawna Moyle, the Inclusive Sioux City Committee's chair, and two other members, Sarah Bernstein and Erica Carta, met with the city manager Bob Padmore and Councilman Alex Waters, according to a source familiar with the meeting. A recording of that closed-door meeting, which is just over an hour in length, was obtained by the Journal. Since Iowa requires one-party consent, one person can legally record a conversation without telling the other person. Padmore said on the recording of Gebrekaden, she's not being punished for anything right now. She's being investigated for some things that have happened. I'm frustrated that it's 5 weeks in and I cannot tell you where it's going to end. I'm hoping sooner than later. Padmore stressed that Inclusive Sioux City movement is very important to the city. He said, people are watching what we are doing. I think the best thing that we can do is show that Inclusive Sioux City as a committee and as a movement in our community is alive and well and moving forward. On Wednesday, the 11-member committee held its first monthly meeting at City Hall without Gebrekaden. Tricia Rivers, a Sioux City resident and member of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska, called on city leaders to be transparent. Rivers said, I really don't like the fact that our leadership is going to different people in this community like it's not going to come back to us. We deserve transparency too. We are a governmental body. So please, continuing forward, I urge you to have all stakeholders at future meetings. Let's be transparent. Let's air it all out. The idea for the committee came out of meetings between city staff and Sioux City NAACP leadership in the wake of protests that erupted in May 2020 following the death of George Floyd, a black man who was killed by an ex-Minneapolis police officer. The talks were designed to explore how the city could begin moving forward. Gebrekaden worked in a variety of diversity, equity, and inclusion positions throughout her time in college. Before coming to work for the city of Sioux City, she was employed as an HIV case manager at Siouxland Community Health Center. In March 2023, Gebrekaden was honored during the 38th Annual Women of Excellence Awards ceremony with the award for Women Striving to Improve the Quality of Life. Then, in November, Gebrekaden launched a campaign for a vacated Sioux City School Board seat. She ultimately lost the election to Dan Greenwell, who is currently serving the two-year term on the board. And the second council story headline is, Council votes to terminate development agreement with Lamb Arts. The Sioux City Council voted Monday to terminate a development agreement with Lamb Arts for the renovation of the city's first auditorium and forgive a $350,000 loan the city gave the performing arts group nearly 7 years ago. There was no discussion on the matter before the council approved the resolution to terminate the agreement by voting in favor of its consent agenda. Lamb purchased the auditorium at 625 Douglas Street in 2017 with plans to transform it into a regional theater. The auditorium, which was built in 1909, most recently housed KCAU's television studios. Red tag since June 2022, the building's roof began leaking in the fall of 2022 and gradually collapsed on the brick structure's west side. Lamb founders Russell and Diana Woolley sent in an email, which was addressed to Lamb Theater friends and family and sent Monday evening. The building was not structurally sound and would need to be demolished immediately. After much discussion with our project management team and several consultants, we realized that the financial resources needed to secure the property would deplete the funds we have been able to secure for the construction of the new space. Everyone involved felt that returning the building and securing a new site was the proper course of action, the email said. The Woolleys said Lamb intends to move forward in a way that will allow it to best steward the contributions that received from supporters for the project. The email continued, "Despite this unforeseen delay, our board and staff remain committed to building a new theater, and we are sincerely grateful for all the support being shown as we continue to work towards that goal. While we are disappointed by this setback, we are aware that the perfect location for the new Lamb Theater is out there, and we are excited to start the work of finding that ideal location so that we can begin construction on a new facility, which will allow us to best serve our mission and community." Benson Building developer Steve Nelson asked the council in late January to take action on the auditorium, even if it means tearing down the historic building, which is across the street from his property. Lamb paid $400,000 for the auditorium, purchasing it in November 2017 from Lloyd C. Archer Dunbar, according to the Sioux City Assessor's website. The Woolleys previously told the council Lamb raised a substantial portion of its $20 million project goal and made progress towards securing various tax credits, grants, and private contributions. The city recently made a formal request to Lamb to provide a report on the old auditorium's structural condition. In October 2017, the city council approved a $350,000 economic development loan with a 4% forgivable interest rate to Lamb to purchase the building. The loan was to be paid in full on October 22, 2018, at which time the 4% interest rate would be forgiven. Lamb announced in 2020 that it had received $500,000 from the Blue Stem Fund for the project. Prior to that gift, the nonprofit theater had received grants from the Margaret Ann Martin Everest Foundation, Missouri River Historic Development, and Gilchrist Foundation, as well as a Grayfield tax credit. In February 2020, the council approved an ordinance designating the auditorium as a local landmark, which made it eligible for state historic preservation tax credits. A year later, the city also received a $300,000 grant from the Environmental Protection Agency to conduct brownfield assessments on a handful of older properties around town, including the auditorium. Lamb requested multiple extensions for the repayment of the economic development loan, which were granted by the council. The final extension required payment of the loan on October 19, 2023. According to city documents, Lamb failed to repay the loan in full and, to date, has made no payments on the debt. Lamb also failed to properly maintain the building, which led to the building being deemed unsafe and placarded on June 3, 2023. City staff worked with Lamb and its representatives to negotiate a non-judicial foreclosure of the mortgage. If approved by the council, the development agreement will be terminated, the mortgage released, and the promissory note forgiven. The city will be taking title to the building in lieu of foreclosure and will be assigned rights to any insurance proceeds on the building for an existing insurance claim which is under appeal, city documents stated. After further evaluation, city staff plan to bring forward recommendations for the future of the building. The American Legion Post 64 once owned the building and operated it as Tomba Ballroom. Last month, the council voted to terminate Lamb's lease of the former Webster School for failing to keep the building in a reasonably safe and serviceable condition. The nonprofit professional non-equity theater had been leasing the two-story brick building at 417 Market Street from the city since April 20, 2015. On February 21, 2023, the city notified Lamb that holding assemblies or classes in the building was prohibited due to life safety concerns. A draft of the termination notice, addressed to the Woolies and signed by City Manager Bob Padmore, stated that the city did a number of inspections on the building and found that the building was not being maintained in a reasonably safe and serviceable condition. In February, Lamb announced a partnership with Morningside University to temporarily bring Lamb Theater productions to the Sioux City College's Klinger Neal Theater at 3700 Peters Avenue. Lamb School classes will also transition to Morningside's campus, according to a statement issued by Lamb. Russ Woolley, who serves as Lamb's managing artistic director, said the decision to move all activities to Morningside University was a direct result of the deteriorating condition of the current building, a former school on the west side. "We have been producing quality live theatrical entertainment in Siouxland for 44 years. The old Webster School at 417 Market Street has served us well for 38 of those years, but that building is no longer sustainable as a venue for our production and Lamb School classes," he said in a statement. Ex-Sioux County deputy's wife pleads not guilty of child neglect. Orange City. The wife of a former Sioux County Sheriff's deputy has pleaded not guilty to numerous counts of child neglect. Jill Haverdink, 38, of Morris, Iowa, entered her written plea Friday in Sioux County District Court to seven counts of neglect or abandonment of a dependent person. Her husband, Caleb Haverdink, 37, pleaded not guilty to the same charges last week. Both were arrested in February after an Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation probe revealed that two foster parents knew a child in their care had committed numerous acts of sexual abuse and sexualized acts against other children from 2019 through October 23rd and took no meaningful action to stop it or protect the other children. The Haverdinks are accused of providing inaccurate information about incidents to the Iowa Department of Human Services or providing information about completely different incidences that were later determined to be unfounded. Caleb Haverdink was fired by the Sioux County Sheriff's Office on February 14th. Sioux Falls facility where Sioux City mail is processed faces closure. South Dakota's congressional delegation opposes the potential shuttering of two South Dakota mail processing facilities. Republican Senators John Thune and Mike Rounds, along with Republican Representative Dusty Johnson, sent a letter last week to U.S. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, asking him to reconsider moving mail processing out of Sioux Falls and Huron. Sioux City's mail is processed and distributed in Sioux Falls. The U.S. Postal Service closed Sioux City's mail processing and distribution center more than a decade ago and transferred those functions to Sioux Falls. The recommendation was finalized in February without taking into account local concerns, according to a press release from Rounds. If the Postal Service follows through, Rapid City will be the only remaining processing facility in South Dakota. A press release from Johnson's office says moving operations from Sioux Falls to Omaha and from Huron to Fargo would be inefficient and cause delays for South Dakotans. This move will require any mail sent from Sioux Falls to Chamberlain, for example, to go all the way to Omaha, then back over to Chamberlain, a 500-mile journey, Johnson said in a press release. In the joint letter to DeJoy, the officials say they understand the importance of modernization and streamlining the Postal Service, but that such changes should not come at the expense of rural and highly rural populations in South Dakota or similar states. The letter also mentions that postal customer service centers in Pierre, Mobridge, and Aberdeen were closed in 2012, which forced the rerouting of local mail and packages. Closing the Sioux Falls and Huron facilities would create delays, particularly during South Dakota's harsh winters, and the additional transportation costs could cancel out any cost savings from the closures. We now move to the Tuesday column of five questions with. And the person today is Rosecrans Jackson's regional president, Julie Enochson. and the topic is on addiction treatment. Rosecrans Jackson Centers offers behavioral health and addiction treatment services in Siouxland for adolescents and adults. In July 2018, Sioux City-based Jackson Recovery Center merged with Illinois-based Rosecrans, one of the nation's largest providers of behavioral health treatment. Rosecrans, a nonprofit organization, provides individual therapy, residential and outpatient treatment services, and recovery living settings for substance use and mental health disorders in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Iowa. At Rosecrans Jackson Center's residential campus at 3500 West 4th Street, adolescents between the ages of 13 and 17, as well as adults, receive residential services and withdrawal management. Just east of the facility are the Women and Children's Center and the Sanctuary Apartments, which offer transitional housing for women. Julie Enochson, who serves as regional president for Rosecrans Jackson Centers, said the majority of moms seeking the treatment are on Medicaid, which only authorizes a residential level of care for 30 days. She said, "Think about a brand new mom who's working on her recovery, trying to figure out how to be a mom with a brand new baby. We also use a halfway house care level of care. They'll transition to a lower level of care so we can keep the women longer. They will be in there 30 days for residential, and then we'll transition to a lower level of care of a halfway house, which allows them to stay in treatment longer. It's the best thing for the mom, best thing for the child." Rosecrans Jackson Centers also has an outpatient location downtown at 800 5th Street, where individual and group therapy sessions are held. She's continued, "A year ago in September, Rosecrans Jackson received the CCBHC, which is a Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics grant. It is $1 billion every year for 4 years, so that's going to allow us to expand our mental health services. Woodbury County is a county that has a high need for mental health services. That's helping us expand mental health services in Woodbury County. That will be located at our downtown location." Rosecrans Jackson Centers has a halfway house for men and a halfway house for women in Sioux City, as well as satellite outpatient services in Lamars, Sheldon, Spencer, Estherville, Cherokee, and Davenport. Enochson spoke with the Journal about the demand for the services that Rosecrans Jackson Centers provides for our latest installment of 5 questions. The first question, what kind of demand are you seeing for the services you provide in this area? How does it compare to other times? Answer, services were high during the pandemic, and then things kind of slowed down. As we have been coming out of the pandemic, things have increased. We have seen a high demand. The problem right now is staffing, just like everywhere else. We could probably fill another 18 to 20 beds if we had enough staff. Most of our beds are full right now. Next question, what are the most common substances people are seeking treatment for? The answer, we are seeing a lot more in opiate and fentanyl, but meth and alcohol are still our top two. Do you have a waiting list? Right now, we do for our residential because of not being able to have enough staff. We have people who are waiting to get into services. We get them in as fast as we can. We stay connected with clients, so if somebody is ready to get in, it might be a couple of days. How important is it to the community to have these treatment services available locally? Just about everybody has some type of connection, whether it's addiction or mental health, or a lot of times they're co-occurring. Having the services here in Siouxland is wonderful because we are the only residential facility in Northwest Iowa. We are the largest facility on the west side of the state of Iowa. In Sioux City, having this here means our local folks don't have to go across the state or go out of state. They can stay here. We have family days on the weekend, so it's easier for families. They can come and spend time with their loved one if they're in treatment. But we serve everybody across the state. How can you convince a loved one to get help? If they need help, you can make sure that they have the crisis line, which is 988. They can contact our downtown location and we can get them in for an assessment. Basically, it's encouraging them. It's giving them the resources. Your Life Iowa is an online website that has a lot of resources as well. I hate to say this, but sometimes people want to go to treatment where they don't live. That's where Your Life Iowa is great. That's where they can find another location to go to. But we always want them to come here because we are the best. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, April 16th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to the obituary for today. It is with great sadness that the family of Judith Gay Bundy Graber announces that Judy passed away on Saturday, April 13th at the age of 83, surrounded by her family. The funeral will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, April 18th at the Sergeant Bluff United Methodist Church. Visitation will be from 10:30 to 11 a.m. at the church. Burial will be in the McCook Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Waterbury Funeral Services of Sergeant Bluff. Judy was born to Mark and Lois Bundy in Gillette, Wyoming on December 23, 1940. She was welcomed by her three siblings, Marion, Arlene, and Louise. She attended Campbell County High School, where she was voted the first woman student body president. Judy attended St. John McNamara School of Nursing in Rapid City, South Dakota after graduation. She continued her education at St. Joseph's School of Nursing in Sioux City. Later, as part of her clinical training at Yankton State Hospital, Judy met and fell in love with Morris Graber, a handsome young orderly who also worked there. The couple was married in August of 1962, and their oldest daughter, Kelly, was born in 1963. Judy graduated later that year and was hired by St. Joseph Hospital. The couple's second child, Jeff, was born in 1965. Maury and Judy moved to their farm in Luton, Iowa, where Mark was born in 1970 and Jennifer was born in 1972. Judy was an active member of her community. She attended the United Methodist Church, where she sang in the choir, was active in women's circles, and was on the church board when the new church was built. Judy also served on the Sergeant Bluff Luton School Board at the time of the current high school was built. In so many areas of her life, Judy naturally rose to the position of leadership. When asked why she was a good leader, Judy said, "Because I have a good head on my shoulders, and I respect that people may have a different opinion than mine, and that's okay." Judy also worked for St. Vincent Hospital and Marion Health Center through the years. It was while working as a unit manager that Judy was asked to provide mental health services for first responders after the Oklahoma City bombing and the crash of Flight 232 in Sioux City. Judy was a people person whose compassion, empathy, and ability to focus entirely on the person in front of her helped them feel cared for and respected. For her children, she was a role model in lifelong learning as she graduated with her bachelor's in nursing from Westmark College at the age of 50. She continued to work at Marion until her retirement in 2005, ending a 41-year career in nursing. After her retirement, Judy and Maury moved out to McCook Lake, where Judy was free to watch her grandchildren grow into the capable and caring adults she helped them to become. Judy demonstrated grace, courage, and kindness in the face of her battle with dementia, and the family would like to thank the excellent staff at Whispering Creek Senior Living for helping her. Robert Bob Uhl, UHL, 78, of Battle Creek, died Thursday, April 11th. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, April 18th, with visitation from 5 to 7 p.m., rosary at 6:45, and vigil at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, April 17th, all at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Danbury. Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home of Ida Grove is in charge of arrangement. Nina L. Osborne, 89, Anthon, passed on April 10th. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, April 19th at the Anthon Community Methodist Church of Anthon. Interment it will be at the Oak Hill Cemetery. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, April 18th at the Anthon Community Methodist Church of Anthon. Helping with arrangements are Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Anthon. Ronald R. Grove, 87, of Sioux Falls, formerly of Sioux City, passed away on Friday, April 12th at Dow Rummel Village in Sioux Falls following a lengthy illness. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, April 18th at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Burial will follow at Graceland Park Cemetery. Visitation with the family present will be 1 hour prior to services on Thursday. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Avera at Home Hospice of Sioux Falls at 4509 Prince of Peace Place, Sioux Falls, South Dakota 57103, or to former agents of the FBI Foundation, 3717 Fetler Park Drive, Dumfries, Virginia, 22025. Ron was born on January 6, 1937, in Colby, Kansas, to Jacob A. and Mabel Craig Grove. He graduated high school in Colby in 1955. After high school, Ron worked various jobs in Kansas before working as a clerk for the FBI in Washington, D.C. In 1959, he enlisted in the U.S. Army. After receiving his honorable discharge in 1962, Ron returned working for the FBI in Washington, D.C., before taking a position at the Kansas City, Missouri FBI office in October of 1962. Ron met his future wife, Bess E. Bierbaum, who also worked for the FBI. They were married on May 7, 1963, in Miami, Oklahoma. Ron attended 9 years of college at night while working days for the FBI and raising their family in Kansas City. In June 1972, Ron became an FBI agent. Ron and Bess were later transferred to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Rapid City, South Dakota, Sioux Falls, Troy, Michigan, and then eventually to Sioux City, where he retired. Ron was a member of the St. Thomas Masonic Lodge since 1962 in Colby, Kansas. He was a member of the Scottish Rite 32 Degree Masonic Body, American Legion, and the Society of Former FBI Agents. Susan K. Schnee, 74, of Sioux City, passed away on Friday, April 12th, peacefully, comforted by family. A celebration of life service will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, April 19th, at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel, with Chaplain Richard Coggan officiating. Burial will follow at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation with the family present will be 1 hour prior to the services at the funeral home. Susan was born on November 30, 1949, in Sioux City to Charles E. and Avon Morley McKnight. She received her education in Sioux City before her marriage to Milo Rich Snee on June 15, 1968, at the Whitfield Methodist Church in Sioux City. With an exception of 1 year in Mannheim, Germany, while Rich served in the country, Susan was a lifelong resident of Sioux City. Susan worked in retail and was the final inspector at Peck Optical before her retirement. She enjoyed being a Girl Scout leader and helped revitalize the PTA at Cooper School in Sioux City. She had hobbies of crocheting, baking, fishing, camping, but found her greatest joy in watching her children play sports. Kenneth E. Hansen, 94, of Recon, Georgia, formerly of Battle Creek, Iowa, died January 29th. Celebration of life service will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 20th in Anthon Community Methodist Church. The Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Anthon is in charge of arrangements. And that concludes today's obituaries. And we'll move on to an entertainment news piece. Amy Grant to play Orpheum October 11th. Gospel and pop musician Amy Grant is bringing her tour to the Orpheum Theater in Sioux City on October 11th. Tickets start at $59 and go on sale at 10 a.m. Friday and can be purchased online at orpheumlive.com or at the Prime Bank box office, according to a press release from the Oakview Group, which manages the Orpheum. Grant's Christian and pop works have sold more than 30 million albums worldwide, including 3 multi-platinum and 6 platinum and 4 gold. Grant has received 6 Grammy Awards and 26 Dove Awards, a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and a star on the Music City Walk of Fame. She was recently inducted into the Gospel Music Hall of Fame in Nashville. In 2005, Grant hosted the NBC primetime series 3 Wishes. One of the segments of that show took her to Grant Wishes in Lamar's, Iowa. Grant resides with her family in Nashville, Tennessee, and is known for her philanthropy and involvement in local causes and charitable organizations. Man stabbed, woman jailed Monday in Sioux City. A man was taken to a Sioux City hospital with non-life-threatening injuries Monday after police say a woman stabbed him in the shoulder. The stabbing happened at 2:01 p.m. in the 100 block of 6th Street. Sioux City Community Policing Sergeant Tom Gill said the victim and a woman, who was later identified as Amy D. Thomas, 36, reportedly got into an argument before the stabbing. Gill described the victim and the suspect as acquaintances and said investigators believe alcohol was involved. Gil said they definitely knew each other. She stabbed him in the shoulder. He's up at the hospital right now getting treated for a stab wound to his shoulder. Thomas was arrested and booked into the Woodbury County Jail for assault with a dangerous weapon, an aggravated misdemeanor. The stabbing isn't the first knife-related incident involving Thomas. She pleaded guilty in a plea agreement in 2018 to willful injury and going with armed with intent, habitual offender, both Class D felonies. She was sentenced to 5 years in prison on both counts, which she was to serve consecutively. According to Woodbury County District Court documents, on June 18, 2018, Thomas and a woman were involved in a verbal altercation at a multifamily residence in the 1300 block of McDonald Street. Thomas took a large kitchen knife and stabbed the woman in the upper chest area. In January, Thomas was sentenced to 20 days in jail after she pleaded guilty to assault with a dangerous weapon. On December 19, 2023, a man approached Sioux City police officers at the warming shelter at 916 Nebraska Street and told them he had been threatened with a knife by a woman standing across the street. That woman was identified by the victim as Thomas, and the police found her in possession of a knife concealed in a pocket in front of her stomach, according to court documents. Well, I'm now moving to the sports section. We'll begin with a story about the Sioux City Musketeers. The Sioux City Musketeers will get a chance to rest and recharge before playing their first game in the United States Hockey League playoffs. The Musketeers clinched a bye in the first round of the playoffs after beating Lincoln at home in the team's regular season finale Saturday night. The top two teams in each conference earned byes. Best of three first-round series between the number three and number six seeds and the number four and the number five seeds from each division. The Musketeers await the winner of the Lincoln Stars Waterloo Blackhawks series that begins Monday night in Waterloo. Sioux City will play at Lincoln or Waterloo for the first two games of the second round best of five series. Normally, the higher seed hosts game 1, 2, and 5, but the Musketeers' home ice at Tyson Events Center is not available for games 1 and 2 because of the Abu Becker Shrine Circus, which runs Wednesday through Sunday, April 19th. If the Lincoln-Waterloo series ends on Tuesday, Game 1 of the conference semifinals will take place Friday and Saturday. If the Stars and Blackhawks series goes to a third game, Games 1 and 2 will be Saturday and Sunday. The last three games of the series would take place at the Tyson Events Center. Game 3 would be played on Monday, April 22nd, if Lincoln or Waterloo sweeps in the first round, or Tuesday, April 23rd, if that series goes three games. Game 4, if necessary, would take place Tuesday, April 23rd or Wednesday, April 24th. Game 5, if necessary, would be played Thursday, April 25th or Friday, April 26th. If the other first-round Western Conference series, the number 4 seed Tri-City Storm, will face the number 5 seed Sioux Falls Stampede starting Monday in Kearney, Nebraska. The winner will play top-seeded Fargo, which won the Western Division with a 50-10-2-0 mark and 102 points. The Musketeers finished second with 74 points, two more than third-place Waterloo. Sioux City and Waterloo entered the final weekend of the regular season separated by just 1 point. The Musketeers lost at Lincoln 2-1 Friday night, while Dubuque handed Waterloo a 6-3 loss. On Saturday, the Blackhawks fell to Des Moines, while the Musketeers outskated Lincoln 7-2. Ethan Gardula and Ty Hansen scored 2 goals apiece for Sioux City against the Stars in the regular season finale, while Landon Gunderson, Max Strand, and Owen Keefe added 1 goal each. The Muskegon Lumberjacks won the Eastern Conference and the top seed in the playoffs. The Dubuque Fighting Saints finished second and earned the other first-round bye in the playoffs. The number 3 seed Green Bay Gamblers faced number 6 seeded Chicago Steel, and the number 4 seed Youngstown Phantoms meets the number 5 Madison Capitals in the Eastern Conference first-round series. The winners of the conference semifinals matchups will move on to best-of-5 conference final series. The format of conference final will be 2-2-1, with games 1-2-5 at the higher seed. The Eastern and Western Conference champions will meet for the Clark Cup Final, a best-of-5 series played in the 2-2-1 format, with the higher seed hosting games 1, 2, and 5. And then our next sports story comes from the Sioux City Relays. Seniors from MOCFV and North earn MVP honors. Though they run in events on opposite ends of the track and field spectrum, Sioux City Relay's MVPs Tierney Huss and Nathaniel Keifel share a drive to consistency, shave time off their runs. As part of their efforts, at the 59th Sioux City Relay at Elwood Olsen Stadium in Sioux City over the weekend, the pair of high school standout preps were recognized for their efforts, yet another feature in the caps of the two accomplished seniors. "Winning the award means a lot," Keifel said. "It means the hard work is paying off. When I start running, I just feel happier. All the things in my head just go away. Since I've started freshman year, I've just loved the competition." Huss, a senior at MOC Floyd Valley, has gradually emerged as one of the state's best sprinters regardless of class. At the relays on Saturday, Huss won 4 golds in one individual event and 3 more as part of the Dutch relay teams. In the girls' 100-meter dash, Huss was able to beat reigning Class 4A state 200 champion Eliana Harris of South Sioux City East by 0.02 seconds with a winning time of 12:37. "Little things matter a lot," Huss said. "I've been working on my start since I started running track, and I think that's helped cut down time a lot." Between the 3 MOC Floyd Valley relays that Huss won gold on in the Class B division, 2 bested the standing meet record for the fastest Class B time ever at the annual event held on the Morningside campus. In the girls' Class B 400 relay, Huss was joined by sophomores Kaylee Tucker and Addie Jeltman, as well as senior Peyton Kleinhesselink. The Dutch's time of 49.79 seconds beat Glenwood and Okoboji in a race all 3 topped the previous meet record, set by Cherokee in 1991. Tucker led off all 3 relays. Huss ran the anchor legs in the 4x100 and 4x200, and the 200 leg third in the sprint medley as Jeltman's 400 finished off the victory. "There was a lot of good competition here," Huss said, "but our team has been training hard all year trying to come out on top, and that hard work is paying off. I think we're able to get off to really good starts, and the speed just carries through." With junior Maggie McEwen in for Jeltma in the 800 relays, MOC Floyd Valley turned in a time of 1 minute 43.98 seconds to beat Glenwood's, as both set a new meet standard. The previous record went to Kingsley Pearson Woodbury Central in 2021. Huss, Tucker, Jeltman, and Kleinhesselink also won gold in the 800 sprint medley, beating Sioux Center's team of Carly Dunn, Taylor Halverson, Avery Bitker, and Colby Oldenkamp by 0.04 seconds. As a junior, Huss took 4th at the Class 3A Iowa State meet and 7th at the Drake Relays in the 100. With times in the 100 that meet the Drake Relays blue standard, Huss has assured her spot on the blue oval in the coming weeks. That four-time Drake Relays qualifier, as both 400 and 800 relays have met the blue standard as well. "We want to go place at Drake and just compete in multiple events and hopefully medal in multiple events," Huss said. "I think that's our main goal, besides just wanting to keep running better times and improving all overall. It feels great to have all my teammates by my side and seeing what we can accomplish together." And now moving to the boys. Keifel, a Sioux City North distance runner, spent his early days learning from the stars runners that came before him and helped shape a program at North that's historically been one of the Iowa's best among boys' cross-country and distance running teams. Keifel said, "I've been around great runners like Gabe Nash and Will Lohr, and they've pushed me and helped me get to where I am now. I want to be great like them. It's a day-to-day thing that I take every workout seriously." On Saturday, Keifel won the 1600 and the 3200. Keifel took the 1600 with a time of 4:22:37 to beat Glenwood's Brian Keller by a little under seconds. A South Dakota cross country track commit, Keifel ran a 9:22:20 in the 3200 to win in a convincing fashion as he crossed the finish line more than 8 seconds ahead of Dakota Valley's Joe Cross, who was 3rd in the 1500 behind Keifel and Keller. The 3200 time for Kiefel broke the previous meet record of 9:22.77, set by Gable Sepurda of Central Lyon in 2017. At state cross country in October, Kiefel finished third in Class 4A with a time of 15:25.60. Kiefel won the Missouri River Athletic Conference Championship cross country meet in October by running a time of 15:30.29 and was a district champion by running a 15:20.50 at the Ames State qualifying meet. In track, Kiefel was runner up in the 1600 meter run to teammate Gabe Nash at last season's MRAC championships with a time of 4:26.17. He took fourth at state in the 1600 last spring and ninth at the 3200. Like Huss, Kiefel has earned an automatic spot at the Drake Relays. Last season, he took 10th in the 3200 and 17th in the 1600 on the Blue Oval at Drake Stadium. "I think I'll be in some very exciting races at Drake," he said. "There's always great competition there. Then after that, just focus on the conference meet and state." Kiefel and Nash once again got to share the same track at this season's Sioux City Relays as Nash ran in and won the men's 1500. "It was fun watching him again," Kiefel said. Nash, a Drake Relays and state champion while at North, was able to compete unattached on Saturday since he's redshirting for the outdoor season at the University of Nebraska and finished the 4:02.29. "The amount of mileage running has definitely picked up in college," Nash said, "but it was fun to make it back here and run." And well, now we'll move to Dear Abby, and we'll begin with this letter. "Dear Abby, I am a professional, well-educated adult who moved back home because of concerns about my father's health, as well as having landed a much better job. As an extra perk, I've been able to save money to pay toward my student loans, as well as spoil my parents a bit as they grow older. I recently gifted my parents, for the second time, their dream vacation. They loved it the first time and never imagined they'd be able to do it twice. Because my parents still have a minor child who cannot remain alone, I am choosing, as I did last time, to use my personal vacation time to babysit. My mother has been planning the details of her upcoming trip and has now asked me to take more time off so they can have a road trip after their vacation. Abby, I am already draining every bit of my time off for their week-long vacation and will not be able to have a vacation myself until later in the year when I accrue more time. I know she's requesting this to make the trip more fun for my father. Although I'm a generous and patient person, this has left me feeling almost speechless, a bit unappreciated and frustrated. Am I overreacting? Should I find a way to extend their trip? Signed, Limited in Ohio." And Abby's response: "The answer to both of your questions is no. Your mother apparently does not appreciate how generous you have been in providing these vacations for her and your father. If she wants to extend their holiday, she should make her own arrangements for your sibling to be supervised if she and your dad will not be available to do it themselves. Shame on her for trying to foist that responsibility onto you." "Dear Abby, I lost my darling wife recently. Her death was a shock to everyone. She was placed on life support for a short period while the medical staff performed tests to determine the extent of her injuries. When it became apparent that she would spend the rest of her life in a vegetative state, no decisions had to be made by her family or by me. My wife had an advance directive in place stating she did not want to remain living in this condition. I was extremely fortunate in that no one in her family wanted to contest the document. As hard as it was for me to discontinue the life support, I knew it was what she wanted. She passed peacefully, quietly, and quickly. Abby, please encourage your readers to make the time and make the effort to have an advance directive drawn up, whatever their desires may be. It was my wife's last gift to me, and I will be forever grateful for it. Signed, Remembering Her in Arizona." And Abby responds: "Please accept my sympathy for the loss of your wife. I appreciate you taking the time to share this important information with my readers and with me. Your letter serves as a reminder that all end-of-life documents should be reviewed regularly to be sure they reflect one's current thinking." And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, April 16th. I'm Dagna, your reader. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And thank you for listening.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.